This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick sitting in for John Hockenberry today. We thank you so much for listening. And on this Friday, the jobs numbers are showing huge gains. The economy added 271,000 jobs last month, way above expectations, pushing the unemployment rate down to 5%. So more people are getting back to work. That's a good thing. But what about the prices of the things that we buy? Now, The Economist may be published over in the UK, but they have a very American way of measuring costs. It's called the Big Mac Index. It uses the price of a McDonald's staple Big Mac to calculate inflation country by country and year by year. And in 1993, Americans paid around $2.30 for a Big Mac. Compare that to today, we're now paying nearly $4.80 for the exact same sandwich. That's more than 100% increase in 20 years. But you need a road to get to that McDonald's drive-thru, and not all prices have gone up in the last two decades. The House of Representatives managed to pass a $325 billion highway and transit bill on Thursday. Now, the money to pay for it hasn't gone up since Bill Clinton was in his first term. There's a guy who used to love a Big Mac. That was 1993, and it was the last time we raised the gas tax to 18.3 cents per gallon. And that's a big problem for our crumbling transportation infrastructure. According to our first guest, Ray LaHood served as transportation secretary in President Obama's first term, and he represented Peoria, Illinois in Congress for seven terms. His new memoir is called Seeking Bipartisanship, My Life in Politics, and he says it's time for Congress to get real about infrastructure spending and also to get real about cooperation.
I think the idea that we haven't raised the gas tax in more than two decades, you can't think of anything that hasn't gone up. In two decades, everything has. Congress really should come to grips with this and raise the gas tax and index it.
All right. So you know Paul Ryan. I'm sure you've known him for years. Yep. I know you have. You stroll out of here and you dial him up, get his direct line, his cell phone, and you say, Paul, I know you're a conservative. Raise that gas tax. It's important. And they'll build roads in Janesville, Wisconsin, too. You can get away with it. What does Paul Ryan say to you today?
He says no.
Right. Yeah. Why? What's going on?
Well, because I think conservative Republicans think that there'll be a backlash. And my argument would be the 14 states that raised the gas tax in their own states over the last 2 years, no politicians have been thrown out of office.
All right, so let's take a step back from transportation. There's a million other issues confronting Paul Ryan, a man you know. What's your assessment of the Ryan moment right now in the Republican House, his mission, his ability to lead them, and whether they're willing to be led? That's the big question.
Well, I think that Paul is obviously a new generation. I think that if Paul were to adopt the idea that when you're elected speaker, you're not elected speaker of your party, you're elected speaker of the whole House. During the time that I worked for Bob Michael, when I was his chief of staff, and he was the minority leader with Tip O'Neill as speaker, Tip O'Neill allowed Republicans to offer amendments. Tip O'Neill allowed debate on issues that he didn't agree with, but he said, hey, I'm the speaker of the whole House.
So let's take it back to the present day, because Americans have heard, when you were Secretary of Transportation, your calls for bipartisanship. It's the theme of your book. It was one of the themes of your career, The Man from Peoria. It's one thing for you to say that the Tea Party factions, the conservatives, aren't interested in governance and they just kind of want to debilitate the government. But it seems to me, for lack of a better word, that we're stuck with this dynamic for years. I mean, gerrymandering, a lot of these members are going to be entrenched. It doesn't seem like the victories that conservatives have had are going to sign them up for the Ray LaHood prescription here. I mean, they're kind of on the rise, aren't they? Why should they change now?
You know, I take your premise, but I will say this. If Republicans who are in the majority in the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate do not do some significant things to solve the country's problems, whether it be immigration or tax reform or infrastructure, I believe the election a year from now, I think it will be very easy for Democrats, with Hillary as their nominee, to say, we need a change, not just a change in the House and Senate, but we need a change of direction for people who want to get things done. And even though Tea Party House members, many of them are in safe districts, if they cannot produce an agenda worth of accomplishment, there's a good opportunity for Democrats to take over either the House or Senate as the Democrats continue to maintain the White House.
Colin Powell said the other day that he remains a Republican and he remains one because it annoys current Republicans. And I thought, that sounds like LaHood. Are you in the same boat?
Look, I'm a Republican. I've always been a Republican. I wouldn't have been able to serve in President Obama's cabinet if I hadn't been a Republican, because they were looking for a Republican to show their bipartisan stripes. And I've given money to Jeb Bush. I hope he gets the nomination. I think he could put up a good fight and actually win the White House. So I'll always be a Republican.
Let me ask you one more before I let you go, also from the news. There have been some reports from your time as secretary. You used private email. You got a lot of private emails, but that you made a lot of effort because of instructions from the White House to transfer those emails to proper public addresses, trying not to use your private email for official purposes. Now, your counterpart over at State, Hillary Clinton, handled this very, very differently. And you're one of the people in the best position to know what it's like. How do you assess how she handled this situation, both at the time and in the aftermath?
I think that she's admitted that it was a mistake, and she's admitted that this was probably not the right thing to do. Whether there's any secretive or top secret or high level emails that came to her private server and to her private account, the FBI is looking into that. But I agree with her. This was not the proper way to handle it.
And you didn't do it that way.
And I don't think any other cabinet member did it that way either.
Ray LaHood served 14 years in Congress. That's 7 terms and a term as Secretary of Transportation for President Barack Obama. His new book, Seeking Bipartisanship, My Life in Politics, filled with backroom stories of leadership coups, legislation, and political fights. Ray LaHood, thanks for joining
us. Thank you so much.
Russia, the UK, Germany, and several other European countries have all suspended flights to Sharm el-Sheikh, located on the southern end of the Sinai Peninsula on the Red Sea. The US and Britain, meanwhile, are now running with the ball that the Russian Airbus A321 that crashed last Saturday likely was brought down by a bomb.
We're going to spend a lot of time just making sure that our own investigators and our own intelligence community figures out exactly what's going on before we make any definitive pronouncements. But it is certainly possible that there was a bomb.
So there's a president and a White House urging caution, even as they traffic in speculation. Now, Egypt and Russia and other countries face tremendous fallout if indeed it was ISIS that brought down that Russian jet. But perhaps the better question now is why the UK and the United States seem to want the world to have a conversation of the what-ifs and the maybes about whether ISIS brought down that Russian jet. Patrick Skinner is director of special projects for the Sufan Group and a former CIA case officer. Patrick, welcome.
Thank you.
Patrick, you've said that a new narrative of ISIS and its capabilities has already begun to solidify here, regardless of whether the bomb speculation driven by the U.S. and the U.K. winds up being true or not. What does that mean?
It means that by claiming responsibility so quickly and then repeating it, that the narrative is indeed set. There will be half the people on the planet that will, you know, no matter what comes later, you only get one chance to make a first impression. And the first impression of this tragedy is ISIS brought down an international flight.
So you're making the point that that first impression is key. And then it brings me back to the United States for a moment, because the U.S. is famous from that briefing room or anywhere else for not speculating on terrorist attacks until they know the evidence. So what would be the motivation of U.S. and U.K. officials on the highest levels to immediately launch into speculation on the world stage that this is indeed a terror attack?
It is markedly different in the past. We tend to downplay threats. From my experience, it says that they have something that was pretty alerting, that the cumulative weight of the chatter, the terrorist communications that they intercepted and then probably looked at somewhat after the fact, plus the fact that they have a heat signature in midair, which is unusual, and a wreckage over the ground, plus you have a capable group that is indigenous to that area. I mean, the Sinai Peninsula has long been a hotbed. And so maybe the cumulative weight, or they have something very specific, has led them to say, hey, this is a big deal. It also brings up the fact that they might be concerned that there is a continuing threat. And I think that's the more important thing. When ISIS made the claim, they didn't say how they did it. And if it was a passenger, they would have probably released a martyrdom video.
Is there a broader strategy possibly at work here? I was thinking about this, and I think that if I wanted to get the recalcitrant Russians to change their approach and their calculations in Syria or against ISIS. I might want them to think or operate under the idea that ISIS is killing its citizens and downing its jets.
Yes, there are huge geopolitical ramifications for this act. The U.S. and the U.K. aren't going to fabricate an entire scenario, but they certainly will take advantage of the fact that if it was ISIS against an entirely Russian target, that they're going to point that out and say, this is a consequence of your intervention. Now, that's a double-edged sword because we're also intervening and we've also been targeted.
So what do the Russians have at stake here? They've spent a lot of time resisting this narrative from their own podiums. What do the Russians have at stake in the world believing, at least at this point, that ISIS is putting bombs on Russian jets?
It's more of a domestic political issue for Putin. Basically, he wants a consequence-free military intervention in Syria. And so far, he's got it. The loss of 224 Russian citizens on vacation certainly would be a consequence, and it would refute his idea that you could just get away with intervening in Syria.
Well, at this point, does it do anything for the American and British desire to get Russian jets to target ISIS instead of just the fighters who are fighting against Assad?
Yes, it probably will help them focus a little bit, but I don't think Putin has always shown that when pushed, he's going to keep moving forward on his path. And so I don't think this is going to change the overall strategy. Putin is determined to help the Assad regime. They might focus a little bit more on ISIS and Raqqa in the northern parts of Syria, where they haven't really been. I think 10% of their strikes are actually anti-ISIS. So they might increase that, but it's not going to fundamentally change their military intervention.
At the same time, Patrick Skinner, we're used to terrorist claims of responsibility for attacks. I think we all get why that happens, the glory, the fear of your adversaries. But has ISIS already won here in a way if the narrative has been set? As you said, the truth has sort of been created that they're bringing down jets in the Sinai?
Yeah, it's a mix of propaganda and reality. I mean, there really is a jet that has been exploded in some form or fashion over the Sinai. Whether they did it or not is still unclear. And it's really interesting because this is one of those rare cases where we're probably going to definitively know within a week or two. This isn't over the ocean. The plane is actually found. So forensics are going to tell us what happened. But the intelligence chatter and then the propaganda from the other side is going to kind of dictate whether anyone believes it or not.
And if you were waiting on these reports from the desert as a CIA officer yourself, if you were still there, would you trust Egyptian aviation authorities to tell the world the truth about what brought down that plane?
No, and that's one of the problems is both the two lead countries that are doing the investigation, Russia and Egypt, are highly motivated to ensure that this is not seen as a terrorist attack. Egypt's economy is not even recovering from the revolution, and Sharm el-Sheikh is one of the few economic bright spots, and this would be a devastating blow. So both parties on the investigation, I'm not suggesting that they're going to fabricate, but they're certainly going to slow down and frustrate and make sure that it's seen in the best possible light for their self-interest.
As the world experiences speculation from the highest levels of United States and UK government on what brought down a Russian jet in the Sinai Desert, Patrick Skinner, Director of Special Project at the SUFON Group, thank you so much.
More than welcome.
On Thursday, the European Commission announced that more than 3 million more refugees and migrants are expected to arrive in Europe by the end of 2016. There's no expectation that that tide of migrants is going to slow down, even as colder temperatures in the winter set in. Manveen Rana is a senior broadcast journalist at BBC Radio 4, and she spent the last 4 months following the Dini family. They're a Syrian family of five attempting to reach Europe, and she's been broadcasting their journey on the BBC program The World at One. Now, Manveen first connected with the Denis in August. After fleeing the Syrian city of Dara, they spent 2 years living in Jordan as refugees. They then set their sights on the Netherlands as a place to start a new life. But even then, the timing of their journey was crucial. Listen to 16-year-old Abian speaking to Manveen just a few weeks ago.
At the end, they will stop accepting more refugees. So that's why we had to go fast and quickly, not waste any time. Because if we waste time and they close the borders, we will have no other chance.
It's a story, a real-life story, where time is precious and the perils are many. Manveen Rana joins me now from London. Manveen, welcome.
Hi.
So tell us about the Dini family. Your spokesman there is a 16-year-old. What about the rest of them?
Yes, the 16-year-old, I think, has grown up very fast. There's a mother and father, Abdurrauf and Majd. They're a fairly middle-class background in Syria, but their life, ever since the war broke out, has more or less been on hold. Majd has two brothers who protested against the Assad regime. They were arrested about two years ago, and they haven't been seen since. The family more or less assume that they've probably been killed. That's partly why the family felt they had to flee Daraa in the first place. They've got three sons. One of them is still in Jordan, but Abian and Yaman, who are the youngest, are travelling with them across Europe. So Abian is a 16-year-old. As you heard, he's a very bright young boy. He desperately wants to get to Europe, and the prime reason for the family really getting to Europe seems to be their desire for the children to have a better education. They're not getting a very good one in Jordan at the moment. They're living hand to mouth, really. It's very hard for Syrians to be able to get jobs out there. You have to register, and in order to register, you need money. So it's a vicious cycle. The eldest daughter, Alma, who's also travelling, is 22. She'd almost graduated in Syria, so she'd spent 3 years studying at university, and then just as she should have been reaching the end of her education, in the moment when she could go out in the world, the war happened, and she went to Jordan, where she wasn't allowed to go to university without paying much more money than they could afford, and she's basically sat at home for two years, and that's why she kept sort of saying the risks, even though they know they're risking their life making this journey, are worth it because they can't really envisage having much of a life if they don't.
And Abian and the rest of the family are acutely aware of the fact that many Europeans don't want them, will try to turn them away. But they really sort of make a case to you that it's not charity. They're not asking for a handout.
Let them think about it as a donation to help us to find a better life. And by that, we can help them to grow their country and make it better. I think they will see it like they are helping us.
And do you think you deserve it?
Everyone deserves a better life.
It was a striking part of your story, their story, Manveen, because you have a family here who was probably in many ways well on their way to success in Syria before it was all taken away, and they just want to continue that.
Absolutely. That's actually something they say very often. They just feel like they want to get their life back. And they genuinely believe, as you heard from Abian there, that they would be bringing something to Europe. You know, they don't want charity. They know they're going to need help when they first arrive, but they're absolutely certain. They reiterated this constantly, that they believe they'd actually be bringing skills. They'd be bringing, you know, that they're desperate to get educated and to be able to contribute to society, and they'd be adding to the economy.
So physical dangers, obviously many. We've seen the images, we've heard some of the reporting, but there's a remarkable scene in your story here where the family is, I think, in Turkey. They're told they're going to take a boat out to sea and that the boat is going to be intentionally scuttled so that the Coast Guard will come and rescue them. They'll have no choice. If the boat is healthy, they just turn them around. Does this horribly, terrifyingly daring strategy, does it work?
It sounds like madness, doesn't it? The bizarre thing is the smugglers tell them so little about the journey they'll be making before they go. And so a lot of this is sort of based on the rumours or the things that they've heard from low-down smugglers who often don't know themselves. But this is something that most of the Syrians I was talking to were going into, you know, completely aware of the dangers, completely aware that at some point they'd have a knife or something. They would have to burst the boat they were on, knowing they'd end up in the sea. And it's particularly terrifying because most of the Syrians I met, including the family, apart from the father, can't swim.
Well, let's not give away the ending of the story. It is the story of a journey, but I think we can say that it has a relatively happy ending. Here's the family arriving in Greece.
What are you? Thanks, God. Finally. How are you?
How are you?
How are you guys? Happy. We are really happy.
My mom was desperate for one day from the journey, and she said I would die if I go back to Izmir.
Really?
Yeah. And I started to cry with her.
Did it feel like you were never going to get here?
A little bit.
So that's where they'd managed to get to a Greek island. And for them, psychologically, I think, that had been the hardest part. They'd been in Turkey for a month at that stage, and they'd tried again and again. Just getting the right smuggler, getting a plan that works, had sort of seemed impossible. They were trying almost every night at one stage, and nothing was happening. And it was also the bit of the journey that they were most afraid of, given they don't swim and given that they'd heard about all the risks. And they sort of assumed that the moment they got to Europe, everything would be okay. Obviously, it's not as simple as that. It's a huge journey. I mean, getting to a Greek island is a hell of a long way from the Netherlands, and there's not very much along the way which makes it any easier for a refugee at the moment. So it's not an easy journey.
The overwhelming numbers of refugees are undeniable. We said 3 million more are expected. The EU knows this. But what needs to happen, based on what you've seen, to stop people having to get on rickety boats, intentionally scuttled, risking drowning, in many cases drowning indeed, so that they can escape this war? What needs to happen on a policy level in Europe to at least make this a bit safer?
It's not for me to say whether these people should be coming here or not. That's not something we would judge. But there are so many things along the way where you think actually the process is so flawed. For example, a lot of the people who are coming, the main driving force seems to be education and the fact that they can't get it in the countries that they're in. So even people who have managed to escape Syria, if they're in places like Turkey or Lebanon or Jordan, they're really struggling.
The real-life journey of the Denis family from war-torn Syria into Europe is told by Manveen Rana on BBC Radio 4. Manveen Rana, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Earlier this week, the Mexican Supreme Court took a step toward legalizing marijuana in that country with a vote by the court's criminal chamber declaring that individuals should have the right to grow marijuana for personal use. Now, the ruling doesn't strike down the country's strict drug laws, which put thousands of people in jail every year on charges of consumption and possession, but it is creating a path for eventual legalization. Mike Vigil is a former DEA agent. He was also DEA's chief of international operations. He worked in Mexico for 13 years. Mike, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, as someone who spent years on the front lines of what has become a war, the drug war in Mexico, what's your reaction to the ruling?
Well, it's somewhat discomforting. I don't see marijuana as a recreational drug. I think it's a very harmful drug. Obviously, the criminal chamber of the Mexican Supreme Court, you know, regulates a lot of the laws that deal with criminal activity, with drug trafficking. But the ruling by the Supreme Court is very restrictive to four individuals who want to form a drug club. So it's not overturning, you know, the laws, as you indicated. But the fact is that it does open up the door. It punches a hole through the legal foundation and the use of drugs in Mexico. So it could lead to further lawsuits opening up the door for full legalization of marijuana.
And it's certainly being interpreted that way. So we're in the throes of marijuana liberalization here in the United States, of course. We have 23 states in D.C. that have medical marijuana. 4 states have legalized recreational marijuana. In that context, what message do you think Mexico, even if the court doesn't intend to send it, what is the message that Mexico is sending to the United States in our sort of complicated long-term drug war relationship?
Well, the fact of the matter is that the drug policies that we have here in the United States are very perplexing. You know, they're very inconsistent, and we hold a lot of countries' feet to the fire in terms of doing more to eliminate drug crops, drug abuse, drug trafficking. And here we are legalizing marijuana, which is, a dangerous drug. So as a result of that, you know, there's many countries who are losing a lot of individuals, citizens, and members of their security forces to drug trafficking violence. And, you know, so there's an inconsistent pattern in terms of what we're doing here in the United States, and it sends a very clear message to many countries that why are we having to do this when the United States is legalizing drugs?
So we see some, at least, nods towards liberalization in Mexico. Bolivia has had some. Uruguay has had some. Is the old unified front in the drug war between the United States and Latin America? Is it over?
I don't think it's over because in Mexico, for example, 77% of the population is opposed to legalization of marijuana. You know, they've taken a very strong stand in terms of combating drugs. But the fact is that, you know, Uruguay in a couple of years ago, you know, legalized marijuana. You know, Chile just recently harvested their first crop of so-called medical marijuana. We have issues now in Colombia where President Santos has stopped the eradication of coca plants because he feels that it might cause cancer. So we are driving this train, and this train, it may be headed to a severe wreck down the line.
As a couple of countries around the Western Hemisphere, including the United States, slowly move to liberalize their marijuana laws, at least state by state in this country, a court in Mexico has opened the door to doing the same. Mike V. Hill says that's a terrible idea. He's a former DEA agent, chief of international operations for the Drug Enforcement Agency. Mike V. Hill, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with the New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
The Peanuts gang hits the big screen for their first feature-length film this weekend, introducing a whole new generation to Snoopy and Charlie Brown, Linus, Lucy, Sally, Pigpen, the whole gang. Now, you might have grown up reading Charlie Brown in an actual paper over breakfast in the morning. Or if not, maybe you confined your Peanuts consumption to Thanksgiving and Christmas and Halloween holiday specials on TV. But Peanuts introduced memes before memes were really an intentional thing in popular culture. Think of Snoopy dancing with his nose in the air, Linus holding that blanket. But the one that stands out the most, it's the moment right after Lucy has yanked that football away from Charlie Brown. He launches into the air, his nose to the sky. He utters one single word before crashing into the ground. Now, on paper, it's spelled all kinds of different ways, a mixture of A's and U's and H's, depending on the day that it happens. But the result always remains the same.
Ugg!
Eric Schulmiller is a cantor and a writer who's spent quite a bit of time dissecting the symbolism of that recurring moment, that tragedy for Charlie Brown. And he's been analyzing the many ways in which Lucy tricks her friend into running in for a kick year after year after year. He wrote about Charlie Brown's endless capacity to be deceived, and he's even researched the origins of that prank for Slate. And he joins me now. Eric Schulmiller, welcome.
Hi, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, how far back exactly does this football prank, this relationship between Charlie Brown and Lucy, go?
So if you're talking about the version that we're all familiar with, where Lucy yanks the ball away and poor trusting Charlie lands flat on his back, that version actually goes all the way back to 1953. But what I discovered when I was researching for this article is that there's actually a darker origin story that goes back even further.
Now, you figured out that, in fact, the first time Charlie got down to kicking the football, he was by himself and it didn't go well. And then he kind of lashed out.
Yeah. So if you look back at the original strip from the even earlier than 1953, you see an amazing image. And if you go to the Slate piece, you'll see images of all these different strips throughout the years. So there's an image of him trying to kick the football without anybody holding it. And he winds up flat on his back all on his own. And then in a strip a few days later, you see him try to kick and miss, and then it pans out and you see these giant looming goalposts that completely dwarf him. It's a very dark image. And he feels humiliated. And in a strip less than a week later, Lucy tries to join the football game. And this is before the gag where she pulls the football has ever taken place. And she misses an attempt at kicking the football, and Charlie Brown humiliates her. He says, "Little girls don't belong on the football field. You should just get on out of here." And she leaves very dejectedly. And in my mind, in a way, this sort of plants the seeds for her anger, which leads to every single year tormenting Charlie Brown for maybe what was an original injustice years earlier.
Eric Schulmiller, we asked listeners about Peanuts and the plot lines and the characters, which ones sum up their worldview. We had a listener in Cocoa, Florida, who said the Chuck Lucy football gag did define them. You feel ahead financially in life, and then it dumps some sort of financial burden on you. And then from Portland, Oregon, we heard everybody knows the scene where after her promise to hold the football for Charlie Brown, Lucy pulls the football away just as Chuck runs up to it and falls flat on his back, but he continues to trust her. Sounds analogous to the American people's trust for our politicians. That came from Portland. What do you think?
I think that the Lucy football gag has become the go-to metaphor for our feelings of betrayal or disappointment when something doesn't work out our way.
And that sort of transcends a million different parts of life, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think we've all experienced that sense in every aspect of our life. And I think that the key for us, as for Charlie Brown, is to keep trying.
Eric Schulmiller, let me try out a fact on you before I let you go, because I'm not sure if you knew this. I didn't know this when I read this. March 30th, 1993. Do you know what happened on that date in the strip to Charlie Brown?
I don't.
Here's one. Charlie Brown hit a walk-off home run and won the game for the first time in his life that day. And then 3 months later, he did it again. He's done it twice. This is in real contrast, isn't it, to the football getting yanked away. The loser who gets his clothes knocked off on the pitcher's mound every other week actually hit two walk-off home runs.
I find that pretty surprising, considering that there was one strip late in the run where Lucy did let Charlie Brown kick the football without pulling it away. And of course, he wound up missing it anyway. So I guess I need to take another look at the baseball story instead of the football story.
Well, you might not be surprised then to know that later on it's revealed that Roxanne Hobbs, who is the pitcher for both of those home runs, she actually hung it over the plate and let him win. She felt bad for him.
Was she the redheaded girl?
No, she's not. She's a different girl. But even in success, Charlie Brown realizes it's not quite success, right?
Absolutely.
Eric Schulmiller's a cantor. He's a writer. As you know, he's been dissecting the Lucy and Charlie football dichotomy in Slate. Eric, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much, Todd.
Well, whether you've spent time analyzing the intricacies of Peanuts or not, can you identify with any of the plot lines? Which Peanut character are you?
This is Mark in Dallas. I most identify with Pigpen. In spite of all the grime and all the mess and maybe not so ideal of circumstances, I still have to find a way to shine and smile and contribute to the world in my own unique way.
This is Martin Labo-Kozer from Somerville, Massachusetts. I can identify closely with several Peanuts characters. Linus, the sensitive, geeky intellectual. Schroeder, who's focused on his art to the exclusion of all else. I'm a professional musician. Snoopy, the exuberant but impractical dreamer. And perhaps even Lucy. She has one good quality in among the abusive and sociopathic behaviors. She really doesn't care very much about anybody else's opinion.
Phoenix, Arizona says, Linus, the squiggles above his head describe my life. From South Carolina, my sister, a Peanuts fan for more than 55 years, says, I am Lucy, the big bossy sister. And from Gainesville, Georgia, Snoopy, because I've always dreamed of big adventures. And in the end, I'm sitting in my house. Doesn't Snoopy sit on his house? Well, anyway, 8778-MY-TAKE is our number, and there's much more at thetakeaway.org. And you can ask me anything on Twitter. You can kind of come along as I talk to Paul Ryan and Nancy Pelosi and John McCain on the Hill. You can ask me about politics or other stuff you like or other stuff you hate. Shoot me your questions. You can follow me at Todd Zwillick. And if you want to take the takeaway with you, subscribe to our podcast. You can find us on iTunes and take us with you on your commute home from work. It's a great way to stay up on the news. Again, find us on iTunes or any other service that you use to get your podcast fix.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 17,000 skills like genetics, graphic design, and golf. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
Bond. James Bond.
You have a nasty habit
of surviving.
Smoke screen?
We're going to have a ball.
Oil slick?
There are two ways to disable a crocodile, you know.
Rear bulletproof screen?
$100 million.
And left and right front wing machine guns.
Regret is unprofessional.
I wonder where you can find your gun, Monsieur Scaramanga.
No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die.
Well, come on, see me. Shaken, not stirred.
Friday is movie day here on The Takeaway, and you can tell from that audio that it's a special movie day. It's Bond Day. With me here in the studio, Movie Date podcast host Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway, with her co-host Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Welcome, Kristen and Rafer.
Hi, Todd.
It's great to have you. We've got Spectre on tap this weekend, the awesome new James Bond film, which we're going to talk about. That's why we have all the James Bond at the top. But first, trivia, of course. You knew I wasn't going to skip this. And it's simple. You're going to listen to this clip. Don't answer yet. We're going to circle back to it at the end after we talk about this week's movie. Name the film. You're going to get a bonus point for naming the villain.
These are outrageous terms.
I want no part of it, thank you.
As you wish. The rest of our discussion must, of course, be confidential. Would you wait outside? Whatever it is.
This way.
So, does anybody else want to drop out?
You're going to name that film, and you're going to get a bonus point for naming the villain. Hold that thought. You both look perplexed. We better move on to Spectre, this week's brand-new James Bond film. This is Daniel Craig's last go at James Bond. Christopher Waltz is in it, which excites me. I love him. Here's a clip.
Well, I can tell you that I don't trust you.
Well, then you have impeccable instincts.
If you don't leave now, we'll die together.
I can think of worse ways to go.
Then you're obviously crazy, Mr.
Bond. James Bond.
Now, Kristen Meinzer, for my money, Daniel Craig is the best of them.
You know, that's your money. And you can spend your money any way you want to. I cannot agree with you on this one. But first of all, let's talk about the plot of this. Not that the plot ever matters in a James Bond movie. In this case, he's trying to uncover the secrets of some sort of sinister organization called Spectre. What is Spectre? What are they going to do? How can he destroy them? What are they going to do to torture him to try and ruin him? And that's him with Monica Bellucci. And she was very, very exciting before the movie came out. A lot of people were excited that James Bond was going to have a romantic interest the same age as him for once, not a 20-year-old. But, of course, she's only on the screen briefly. But she gives him some clues. He follows more and more clues. But then also along the way, he just is very serious. And I really wish that this James Bond was not so serious and not so sullen. And that's my biggest beef with all of the Daniel Craig James Bond movies.
With Daniel Craig. Now, Rafer, I was very excited about the prospect of Christoph Waltz. I assume he's the villain here.
He is the villain. He plays Oberhauser. And I won't say too much more than that because there is a big reveal in the film as to what his real identity is. And I love Christoph Waltz as well. I think he's a great scenery chewer. And I love when he just sort of goes off the rails. He doesn't get to do quite as much of that here, I think, because he's weighed down by some of that narrative backstory. And it's a more serious Christoph Waltz, which I was a little disappointed by.
All right. Well, I'm going anyway, even though nobody loves it. They're still getting my $13, I have to say. I think I decided that when I knew it was coming out. Now, we're going to take it down several notches. Something much more pleasant. We've been talking about Peanuts on the show today. Kristen, you saw the new Peanuts film, which is in theaters. Let's listen.
There's a new kid moving
in. Big brother, put yourself together.
Come on, Charlie Brown.
This time, things will be different.
So much more refreshing than the Dark Spectre.
So here we have Charlie Brown excited, all the kids excited. A new kid is moving into town. Ooh, she's the pretty little redheaded girl that we all know about. And he spends the entire school year trying to win her attentions. Now, this is very, very loyal to the TV specials of Charlie Brown for both good and ill. It's a little bit old-fashioned. It's a little bit hokey. It moves at a pace that I think works better at a 22-minute holiday special. But it's also very sweet and sad, like all of the Charlie Brown specials are. And it does have that wonderful Vince Guaraldi music throughout it, which is enjoyable.
You always have to ask with these films if adults can enjoy it without the kids along or in addition to the kids.
I actually think this is one where the adults might like it better. I think for a lot of kids, it's not going to be as yuck, fast-paced. There's no, you know, pooping jokes in it. And the stuff that kids like nowadays, they might find it too slow. And I think the adults might chuckle with it with nostalgia more.
Yeah, with a lot of memories of Snoopy and Woodstock. Woodstock, especially Charlie Brown. All right, let's move on to Brooklyn to round it out before we get back to that awesome trivia question. This is written by Nick Hornby. I think we have a clip of this as well.
I've enrolled you in a night class for bookkeeping at Brooklyn College. It'll be 3 nights a week, and I paid your tuition for the first semester.
Why?
Why? Not thank you.
Sorry, thank you. Why?
I was amazed that someone as clever as you couldn't find proper work at home. I've been here too long. I forget what it's like in Ireland.
Rafer is a story of a young woman, an immigrant story, leaves Ireland, comes to New York, to the United States, and in the 50s.
Yeah, that's Saoirse Ronan. She plays Eilish. She does. She leaves her family, her sister, her mother, comes to Brooklyn, like so many Irish people at the time. There's a lot of jokes in the film, actually, about how it's just like home. And, actually, you should try to get out more and see people who aren't related to you back home. I wasn't expecting a lot from this film because it looked like just a bit of a meandering story about a girl who comes to Brooklyn, falls in love. She goes back home briefly and maybe falls in love with another man. But I found this film so lovely and such a great invocation of a bygone America and so powerful in the way that it evokes homesickness and the promise of a new life, what you're leaving behind, who you're leaving behind, the things that you do in America, the new world that have an effect on the old world back home. I just thought it was lovely, well-acted, beautifully written by Nick Hornby, and a great-looking film as well. Beautiful.
Kristen, there is a risk, I think, with stories like this that they become New York nostalgia stories.
Yeah.
The people who live here love the immigrant story of their hometown. Maybe not so much in Des Moines. I don't know.
Well, I do think that this does tread on that same ground that we've seen a million times. There's the Italian-American family and the, you know, everyone's eating spaghetti and there's lots of talk of the Dodgers and there's all these things that are Italian-American, Irish-American, Brooklyn-centric, which may feel like we've been down that path a few too many times. And that's a little bit of a problem, but mostly I have to agree with Rafer that it won me over and it was very lovely and very sweet, even if I've been down that path before.
All right. So it sounds like out of all the three films that we heard that maybe Brooklyn is the top winner for this week. I'm still going to see James Bond despite the negativity across the table, but that's okay. I'm still going to see it. Now, speaking of James Bond, we have to go back to trivia. Now, that's your only hint. I played you a clip. Let's listen to it again.
These are outrageous terms.
I want no part of it, thank you.
As you wish. The rest of our discussion must, of course, be confidential. Would you wait outside?
This way.
So, does anybody else want to drop out?
Kristen Meinzer named the film.
Is it Moonraker?
No, Rafer?
I'm completely stumped. The American accents are throwing me. I don't know.
Do you even know the actor that was talking there?
I
that
don't
was Christopher
know.
Walken as Max Zorin in View to a Kill, 1985. Roger Moore as James Bond and Grace Jones as May Day. Guys, thanks so much, Kristen and Rafer, the Movie Date team. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Todd.
Well, here's something to take with you today.
To the Batmobile. Let's go.
Atomic batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
Roger. Ready to move out.
George Barris, the designer of the Batmobile and other specialty cars for television and film, died on Thursday at his home in Encino, California. He was 89 years old. Barris transformed a 1955 Lincoln Futura to the Batmobile in only 3 weeks for the 60s television series, and we love him for it. That's the Batmobile speeding off into television history. Thanks so much for listening on this Friday. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. Have a great weekend. It's The Takeaway.
It's the car, right? Chicks love the car.
PRI, Public Radio International.